Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The hospitalization burden associated with this Omicron wave, it's not as high as we've seen with the other variants.
As COVID circulates widely, state epidemiologists say vaccines and boosters are preventing hospitalizations. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, another record harvest for Bristol-based sockeye salmon run.
I lay in my bed at night with the window open and I can hear them jumping, and it's just amazing. It's absolutely beautiful.
Those salmon, those stories, and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
State health officials say there's a lot of COVID circulating in Alaska, and like the rest of the country, that's predominantly the coronavirus's Omicron BA5 subvariant. Hospitalizations in Alaska have been on a mostly upward trajectory since April, as have case counts. That's even with more people using at-home tests, the results of which aren't reported to the state. Still, state epidemiologist Dr. Joe McLaughlin says vaccinations and boosters, including a second booster available to anyone immunocompromised and those 50 and up, are helping stave off infections or minimizing serious illness. And McLaughlin says even with COVID on the upswing again, people are better protected and there are better treatments than when the pandemic started more than 2 years ago.
It's best to get started on those medications as soon as possible after you test positive. So if you woke up this morning feeling sick and you have a home antigen test, go ahead and test yourself. And if you test positive, go ahead and contact your healthcare provider. Now, if you don't have a primary care provider, there are other options. You can go into an urgent care if you're in an urban setting. If you're in a more rural setting, you could go in and contact a public health nurse who might be able to help link you to a provider and link you to treatment if treatment is warranted for you. Or if you're in a village, you can contact a health aide and try and set up either a telemedicine visit or some other sort of visit where you can, you know, talk with the health aide about your symptoms and they can take a look at your risk factors and whether or not you're eligible for treatment.
Whether you're looking at those test results or hospitalizations and you see an increase here just, you know, recently over the last few weeks, how does that compare to previous waves that we've seen? Or would you even call this a wave? And do you have any sense of how this might play out?
So if you look at the COVID-19 hospital dashboard, going back from our first big wave that occurred in sort of November, December of 2020, the biggest wave that we had was, the winter of 2021 starting to go into 2022. But then in January 2022, we had another big wave. And then now this Omicron wave that we're experiencing is not as big in terms of the amplitude. It's not as high in terms of number of hospital beds occupied per day. So that gives you a sense for the hospitalization burden associated with this Omicron wave that we're experiencing. It's not as high as we've seen with the other variants. What does that translate to in terms of cases? How many cases we've seen? That's a little bit more difficult to answer because, again, we just don't have the surveillance data on cases like we used to. But, you know, right now, our biggest concern is hospitalization and deaths associated with COVID. And fortunately, the death rate is remaining very low.
it strikes me that to become infected now, 2+ years into this pandemic, you mentioned already, there are a lot of other treatments that we didn't have a couple of years ago. And I wonder if you could tell me about that and what impact that's had, I guess, on, you know, numbers nationally and in Alaska.
So there are a number of factors that are contributing to our lower hospitalization rates and probably our lower death rates as well. Number one is just the particular variants that are circulating right now might be less virulent than previous variants, like the Delta variant. Remember, that was very virulent. We saw very high hospitalization and death rates associated with that Delta variant. The other thing is, most Alaskans have had at least one or two doses of vaccine, and we know that prior vaccination does decrease the risk of hospitalization and death, even with the Omicron strains that are circulating. And also, there have been a number of Alaskans who have had prior infection. And again, prior infection, like prior vaccination, is protective against more severe cases.
Well, Dr. Joe, when will the pandemic be over? That's, I think, maybe people want to know that.
I wish I had a crystal ball on that one. I don't know. You know, what we're doing is we're just trying to take this one step at a time and deal with the various waves that are coming up. This is a virus that is not going to go away. We are going to continue to see the SARS-CoV-2 virus circulate in human populations for the foreseeable future globally. And as we've seen with influenza, like the great pandemic of 1918-1919, when we saw the H1N1 influenza virus emerge in human populations and really cause a massive pandemic with high death tolls, that H1N1 virus is still circulating in human populations now. It's much more attenuated. We have much lower hospitalization and death rates now associated with that H1N1 virus than we saw during the 1918 pandemic. But it is still circulating, and I suspect that's what's going to happen at some point with this SARS-CoV-2 virus, is we are going to see one or more strains that will just continue to circulate in human populations, and it may be that we will continue to see new variants emerge like we do with influenza from year to year that we're going to have to manage. And our treatments will continue to improve, and our ability to stave off more severe infection will continue to improve. And hopefully the virus strains that circulate over time will become more attenuated and be less capable of causing severe disease, as we've seen with many of the influenza variants that have emerged over the years.
That was state epidemiologist Dr. Joe McLaughlin. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says as of today, its COVID-19 program for cruise ships is no longer in effect. All of the major cruise lines had voluntarily enrolled in the program. They agreed to report to the CDC daily counts of confirmed or suspected cases aboard each of their ships operating in U.S. waters, and to follow CDC protocols for reducing the risk of transmission and managing outbreaks on board. On its website, the CDC says the cruise lines will continue reporting case counts to the agency, but the CDC will no longer share each ship's COVID status. Up until today, the CDC had been publishing a daily color-coded status indicating COVID risk aboard each ship. The system was imprecise, potentially grouping ships with a handful of cases in the same category as ships with hundreds. On its website, the CDC says cruise travelers can contact their cruise lines directly about outbreaks during their trips. Earlier this summer, though, travelers said cruise lines kept them in the dark during their cruises as COVID outbreaks were spreading on board. Cruise lines participating in the CDC program also had to sign agreements with the port communities they visit. These agreements lay out more protocols for reducing risk and managing outbreaks, with an eye on the impact outbreaks could have on those communities. For example, the port agreements in Southeast Alaska say cruise passengers or crew requiring hospitalization from COVID are supposed to go to Seattle for treatment. In Juneau, Deputy City Manager Robert Barr learned about the CDC's change after a KTOO reporter called seeking comment. Barr wasn't certain, but says he thinks the port agreements will remain in effect. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new sculpture in Fairbanks will honor the first climber to summit Denali.
And they can actually step up and reach up and touch Walter's hand as if he was helping them up the mountain.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Alaska state troopers have called off the search for a 69-year-old woman whose vehicle was found last week in a remote area near Healy with a child inside. The search for Mary Dawn Wilson had been going on since early Thursday morning when troopers got a report that her car had been found stuck in a spot about 7 miles in on the Stampede Trail near Denali National Park and Preserve. Troopers say rescuers found Wilson's 2-year-old grandson locked inside the vehicle. The child appeared to be in good health and has since been handed over to the Office of Children's Services. Later Thursday, searchers found some personal items believed to belong to Wilson about a mile farther down the Stampede Trail. But since then, despite 3 days of aerial and ground searches by law enforcement officers, park rangers, military personnel, and volunteers, they've been unable to locate her. Troopers say they have no evidence of foul play related to Wilson's disappearance. They said in a dispatch issued Saturday that they're discontinuing the search but will continue investigating the case and may resume searching if they get new clues or evidence that warrant it. Troopers are urging anyone with information about the case or who's seen Wilson over the past few days to call them at 907-451-5100 or submit a tip anonymously through the AKTIPS smartphone app or online at dps.alaska.gov/tips. The body of a person who was rafting Saturday on the Sina River near Valdez has been recovered. Alaska state troopers say the person was reported missing around 10:45 Saturday night after his raft tipped and he was thrown into the water at a spot near milepost 32 of the Richardson Highway. Troopers and Valdez Fire Department personnel searched the area and later found the body hung up on a rock in the river. The responders recovered it and sent it to the state medical examiner's office for an autopsy. A trooper dispatch says the agency won't identify the victim until next of kin is notified. Bristol Bay's 2022 sockeye run is now the biggest on record. 69.7 million fish have returned this summer. That surpasses the previous record of 67.7 million fish, which was set last year. KDLG's Izzy Ross reports that even with commercial exploitation of the sockeye populations, fisheries scientists say the recent runs have returned at historically high rates.
More than 3 million sockeye have swum up the Wood River to spawn in tributaries around Lake Alecnagik, about 20 miles from Dillingham. Cheryl Marchand lives along the lake near the head of the river. She has hung commercial fishing nets for 45 years and says this year's runs are remarkable.
We just pour by. Sometimes there's 500 in the air breaking the water when it's dead calm. You can see really well. I lay in my bed at night with the window open and I can hear them jumping and it's just amazing. It's absolutely beautiful.
This year's harvest is also the largest on record. William P. Johnson just finished his 62nd year as boat captain. He grew up set net fishing near Igushik in the 1940s with his family. After more than 6 decades of fishing, he wasn't fazed by the large returns this season.
Our goal was to get at least 100,000, and we exceeded that. And so we came home after our last delivery on our 12th.
For thousands of years, Yupik, Aleutic, and Dena Inna peoples have presided over Bristol Bay. The commercial fishery began in 1884 as outsiders came to the region and built canneries. The federal government managed the fishery until the state took over in 1960. Johnson, who also fishes for subsistence, says the large sockeye runs haven't changed how much food he and his family put away for winter.
there has never been any problem for us in getting our fish, but one thing that has been impacted is a king salmon that seem to have declined.
While sockeye have returned in droves, Chinook and chum salmon runs have dropped. Scientists don't know why that is. Dan Schindler is a professor of aquatic and fisheries sciences at the University of Washington. He has studied sockeye on the west side of Bristol Bay for decades and says the exact reasons for why the bay's sockeye runs are so huge will probably always remain a mystery.
What we have is correlations, and the correlations are that when we've had really warm to hot even, eastern Bering Sea sea surface temperatures, Bristol Bay sockeye have done really well, and other species in the region haven't.
River systems on the west side of Bristol Bay have seen an especially large sockeye boom over the past few years.
All the way up along the west and north side of Bristol Bay, all the way to the Kuskokwim. So something anomalous has happened here, and it has coincided with some of the warmest ocean temperatures ever observed in the eastern Bering Sea and in the Gulf of Alaska.
The sockeye runs now returning to Bristol Bay may be the largest of the past several hundred years. Schindler and other scientists have attempted to reconstruct how big the bay's runs were centuries ago.
Salmon that are coming back from the ocean bring back a distinctive marine nitrogen isotope signature, which we've used to reconstruct how many sockeye were spawning in places like the Wood River and the Quijack and throughout the Togiak Refuge over the last 1,000 years or so.
This is called paleolimnology, where researchers take the mud out of the bottom of lakes and scan that sediment for an isotope, nitrogen-15. Schindler says even with commercial exploitation of the sockeye populations, the recent runs have returned at higher rates than when there was no commercial fishery at all.
It really does support what we've seen with our real-time data over the last 50 or 60 years, that climate warming has actually made these lakes more productive than they were 400 years in the past.
The total run is now over 70 million fish, but the season isn't over yet. Fish and Game forecast a run of 75 million sockeye. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Coast Guard has found a serious defect with a common brand of survival suit that may reduce their usefulness in emergencies. Survival suits, also called immersion suits, are full-body protective suits that the Coast Guard requires on commercial fishing vessels for sailors to wear in an emergency. The suits have flotation devices and are meant to protect sailors from freezing water as they await rescue. Scott Wilbert is the Commercial Fishing Vessel Safety Program Manager for the Coast Guard in Alaska. He says the problem was discovered during a routine inspection in June.
Inspectors that were out in Bristol Bay a few weeks ago reported finding issues with relatively newly manufactured immersion suits. And what they were finding was an area of what appeared to be a delamination or a lack of adhesion of the glue that's used to affix the zipper assembly to the neoprene part of the suit.
The suits are Imperial Immersion Suits manufactured by Servitech, a safety equipment manufacturer based in the United Kingdom that makes everything from lifeboats for submarines to G-suits for fighter pilots. They are one of only a handful of manufacturers approved by the Coast Guard to produce survival suits for use in the United States. Their immersion suits cost hundreds of dollars and can last for many years if well maintained. Wilbert says the Coast Guard isn't sure how widespread the issue is. The problem became apparent in late June, after the Coast Guard notified Servitech. The company told the Coast Guard they had seen suits in Canada with a similar defect. Wilbert says the Coast Guard then began finding more suits in Alaska with the same problem.
I started to get a little feedback from some local Alaskan Coast Guard units who had taken it upon themselves to walk into some of the retail stores and vendors in their towns that they know to sell these products.
The Coast Guard did find suits on shelves that bore the defect. All were Imperial suits manufactured in the last few years. Wilbert says that Servitech is investigating the defect and may soon issue a general service bulletin that will outline the extent of the problem and address possible remediation, potentially including a recall. Servitech could not be reached for comment in time for this story. The U.S. Forest Service is proposing to restore land on an island in the Tongass National Forest that has been logged in past decades. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, the federal agency wants this 23,000 acres of developed land to match the wilderness area that surrounds it.
Cube Cove is on the northwest side of Admiralty Island. The area was heavily logged, mostly by clear-cut in the 1980s and 90s by She Attica, Sitka's native corporation. The U.S. Forest Service bought the land for just over $18 million, completing the deal in 2020. She Attica had done some reclamation work after the logging, but the Forest Service wants to finish it up.
Admiralty Island is a special and unique place, every inch of it anyways.
That's Marcy Johnson, a wildlife and fisheries biologist with the Forest Service.
Certainly some unique characteristics with the concentration of brown bears and eagle nests and a lot of intact old growth forests throughout the island.
Before the federal purchase, it was the largest privately owned land surrounded by a federal wilderness area. It's now joined that protected area known as Kootsnuwu Wilderness, which makes up most of Admiralty Island. She Attica did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Because of past logging, there are many remaining roads, bridges, and culverts. The Forest Service proposes removing three large steel bridges and culverts that would affect fish passage. They also want to remove or modify some of the roadbeds that might affect water flow. Johnson says there is a coho salmon run and trout in the streams.
So eventually, this type of infrastructure does fail and it could become a fish passage issue and water quality issue.
The federal agency is also proposing to thin some of the new growth trees to allow space for larger ones to grow, especially around waterways.
When you don't have these large trees growing around these streams, you don't have that temperature control, and you also don't have this large wood material that ends up in the creeks as good fish habitat.
There are two federally managed recreational cabins on site that see visitors. Johnson says that the driving force behind the restoration project is preserving the wild character of the land, now and in the future.
Providing that wilderness experience in, say, a visitor in 300 years is still important, too.
A few years ago, a pilot project removed a large culvert on a fish-bearing stream near a lake in the area. It was run by the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition with help from an Angoon youth program. The village of Angoon is south of Cube Cove on the western shore. Its residents have lived on Admiralty Island as long as anyone knows, and subsistence fish and hunt there. Charles James is the tribal administrator.
We put up fish to last us the winter. We can our fish, we smoke it.
James doesn't know if any residents go near the logged areas now, but he says restoring the land makes sense.
I think it would be nice to have those trees and stuff growing back and get all that stuff out of there.
The Forest Service plans to do more fieldwork this summer to fine-tune the details of the project, such as what tools and equipment will be needed. They are taking public comment on the proposal through July 22nd. They expect all the work to be completed within 5 years. It's unknown how much the restoration will cost and what partnerships might help fund it, but it's been identified as a priority project by the Tongass National Forest. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
A statue honoring the first climber to summit Denali will be unveiled on Tuesday in downtown Fairbanks. The heavy bronze piece has already arrived in town, and KUAC's Robin got a sneak peek of the uncrating and installation of the statue of Walter Harper.
Jeremiah Howe worked to open up the huge shipping crate that held the statue. The rain had cleared recent wildfire smoke and had held off Wednesday, so the area in front of the Doyon Limited building was dry. Waiting for a lift truck to arrive was Bill Gordon of the Walter Harper Project. The statue is the peak, no pun intended, of work for the project, A committee of historians and relatives of the Athabascan Irishman who was the first to reach the top of Denali. Bill Gordon says the open area, looking over the Chena River, will allow people to get up close and touch the statue.
The committee, when we first put this whole thing together and talked to artists about what kind of a statue we wanted an interactive area, something that people can come and touch and be inspired by and enjoy in the whole area rather than looking up at a figure that they really couldn't relate to.
Walter Harper was a 20-year-old Koyukon man who hiked with Archdeacon Hudson Stuck, Harry Carstens, and Robert Tatum to the mountain in 1913. Harper is credited with the expedition's success because of his subsistence know-how, general health and athleticism, and his good cheer. His positive attitude was noted in many others' journals and letters in many parts of Alaska. That attitude of helping others was something the committee wanted to see reflected in the statue's design.
This has been built in order for visitors to come and they can actually step up and reach up and touch Walter's hand as if he was helping them up the mountain, which is what the image is depicting, is his energy that helped everybody up the mountain when they made that ascent in 1913.
John Thies and workers from his company, Worry Free Alaska, put straps around the heavy bronze. And the lift truck, run by Jacob Wright, pulls the whole thing off the crate and into the air. Sculptor Gary Lee Price, who already has other work in Fairbanks, did another piece to go with the main one that shows Harper against a wall of rock. And that piece is a dog named Snowball. Price wanted to show how important sled dogs were to the expedition. That piece also was lifted into place. A handful of 2-foot-high replicas were made by the sculptor, Gary Lee Price. There are also about 2 dozen even smaller replicas, about 1 foot tall, that the project hopes will be distributed to some Alaska schools to enhance the teaching of Harper's story.
Our goal is to put a couple of Mary Erlander's books into every school.
That book is Emeritus Professor Mary Erlander's 2017 history called Walter Harper, Alaska Native Son.
We're in the process now of designing a curriculum for grade schools and high schools to add to their Alaska history, the story of Walter Harper and the ascent, and also all the other things Walter did to try to bridge the different cultures between the indigenous people and the advent of the Western culture who was coming into Alaska during his time.
After the installation of the Harper Monument and cementing Snowball the dog into place, the whole thing is covered by a tarp. The official unveiling is Tuesday afternoon at 4 p.m. at Doyon Place. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Dylan Smart in Kodiak, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Robin in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank, Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.